Welcome to Business Watch. Well, South Africa is the world's 13th biggest source of greenhouse gases and is going to need to spend $250 billion, that's roughly 4 trillion rand, over the next 3 decades, closing down its coal-fired power plants and replacing them with green energy. That's according to a recent consultation paper. The Blended Finance Task Force and the Center for Sustainability Transitions at Stellenbosch University said that in addition to closing down the country's coal-fired plants and building wind and solar power plants, money will need to be spent compensating coal-dependent communities, really whose livelihoods are threatened by the change, and investing in grid capacity. Now, most of the money will need to come from the private sector, and the estimate comes as South Africa, which relies on coal for more than 80% of its power, is in the process of negotiating an $8.5 billion package or pledge of climate grants and concessional loans with some of the world's richest nations. The potential deal, announced at last year's COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, envisages South Africa retiring some of its coal power plants. And to discuss this, I'm joined now by Mark Swilling, a professor at the Center for Sustainability Transitions at Stellenbosch University, and Amar Bhattacharya, who is a senior fellow in the Center for Sustainable Development, housed in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institute. Mark, kick us off, and I think it's really important, a significant day, actually, after more than 3 years in office. Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe is going to be signing his first power project. But let's just dial it back a bit, and it's really important to understand what the energy transition means, what a just transition means, before we dive into the paper.
Well, what an energy transition means and what a just transition means are two different things. An energy transition primarily refers to the decarbonization of the economy. So in our case, it would mean coal closure by a certain date. In our report, we're suggesting 2040, in order to reach net zero by 2050, in line with our commitments at COP26. But that doesn't mean we address our socioeconomic challenges of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. So if we want to marry investment in decarbonization with development, that would entail a just transition. In other words, we're looking for an energy transition with social justice outcomes, which would include the eradication of poverty, to use the wording of SDG 1, the reduction of inequalities, and a significant reduction in unemployment. And that's only really going to happen if we see renewables not just as a solution to our energy crisis, but as the driver of the reindustrialization of the South African economy. It could become the biggest job creation program since 94.
And the CEO of the Development Bank of Southern Africa was in Parliament saying just that they're looking at this through the lens of job creation. And I know you also are chair of the DBSA. So it's really interesting to frame it from that perspective. What exactly is the job creation potential that you're referring to in this just transition?
Well, there's three different categories of job creation potential that we've studied in great detail as the CST, but in my capacity as DBSA chair, it's what we're focusing on in terms of our investment program going forward. And the three are, firstly, which is what most people focus on, is the jobs that will be created in constructing the solar and wind power plants equal to about 5 to 6 gigawatts per annum for the next 20 years. And we've already built over the last 10 years 6 gigawatts, and that created 50,000 jobs. So the assumption, we've done it empirically. That's the truth. So what we can say is, more or less, that's what we'll achieve going forward per annum, construction jobs. But then the second category is downstream service sector jobs, and those are fairly underestimated internationally. We've calculated it out as fairly significant job creation, transporting towers, cleaning solar panels, etc., and repairs and maintenance, more skilled. And then the third and most important is the upstream industrialization potential. In other words, if we are going to import everything from China, we're not going to create many jobs upstream. But if the prices are right, we will be able to stimulate an upstream manufacturing sector, you know, making things, everything from ball bearings to blades, that will be required, not just in our own economy, but in the rest of Southern Africa and Africa. So we could become the, if you like, the manufacturing base for the kit that will be required within South Africa and across the continent as we progress. And that's going to be the big job creator.
Mark, I just want to stay with you for a second longer on that point, because a great deal of time, effort and resources have been spent on studying what's going on in the Mpumalanga coalfields. And the communities there are very aware of their reliance economically on the coal industry, and also the risk that the coal industry poses from a health perspective to those very same communities. What is the understanding and the attitudes within these communities towards a transition away from coal and the opportunities, equally the risks?
Well, within those communities, there's already a significant experience of the negative impacts of coal closure without any remedial action. If you go to Hendrina, it's like a ghost town, because of the beginnings of closing down, but also the health impacts, and thirdly, the health impacts erodes the earnings and pensions of workers, because they then have to pay for their health, and that really has a very negative impact. So the real challenge is to make sure that workers and communities realize that there actually is potential in renewables. So it's difficult to have conversations with people who've never experienced the alternative. But that's going to start to happen increasingly, especially if Eskom gets the right to repurpose its power stations and as they close down the coal-fired power stations and build renewable energy. That is going to demonstrate to workers and communities that there is job creation potential in these new renewable infrastructures.
And really, it does come down to those proof of concepts to start bringing people along. Amar, from your perspective and looking at this through the lens of what transpired at COP26, which really was the finance COP, and this paper refers to, and many others are referring to, COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt as the accountability COP, the $8.5 billion pledge by the developed nation partners to South Africa really emerged as one of the marquee pledges out of Glasgow. And so there's a lot of focus on getting this right, on getting the structure right, and still very little understanding, as far as I can tell, of exactly what blend this finance is going to take. Is it going to be grant, concessional, what kind of interest rates might attach, or conditionalities and that kind of thing. Let's just set a baseline here in terms of using this $8.5 billion. Is it being viewed as a proof of concept globally that could potentially be applied elsewhere, places like Taiwan or Vietnam or Indonesia, for example?
As Mark pointed out, the proposition here is not a 1 year, $8.5 billion proposition. It is at a minimum $215 billion over 15 years. It's multi-sectoral. There are aspects of it which the private sector will be willing to finance, although cost of capital is an issue. There are other areas where we will need, significant amounts of concessional finance, especially for meeting the costs of people and places that will be affected by this transition. But also we have to recognize that, particularly both Eskom and the National Treasury are debt constrained. So you can't add a lot more debt, to this to an existing problem to solve this, bring about a long-term solution. So hence, those of us who are looking at the international financing are stressing very much that we need two things. We need a composition of finance that is fit for purpose. So largest amounts, of course, necessary for the big scale-up of renewables, and for green industrialization, which largely should be self-financing, but where we need to put in structures, including structures for risk mitigation. Second, to ensure that we have adequate financing to meet the financial costs of the exit from coal. because closure, and especially early closure of coal-fired power plants, will entail financial costs that have to be met, and they can't be met just by ESCOM. And third, we have to ensure that we have the financing necessary for the social transitions that have to take place. So when you look at it in that kind of a way, the $8.5 billion has to be sort of meet two tests. Is the composition and the cost of capital right? And second, is it something that can be a replicable gain year after year? Because that $8.5 billion is not just a proof of concept for the Indonesians and the Indians. It's a proof of concept for this long-term mutual accountability pact that the just energy transition is trying to put in place.
Mutual accountability pact. Mark, I like that language, because if you look at where the COPs have tended to break down, it's on this recognition that Africa is sort of 17% roughly of the world's population, only 4% of global emissions, and so it's actually net positive, while the developed world really has industrialized on the back of what we now know to be highly polluting fossil fuels. So there is some kind of trade-off here, and a mutual understanding of how that works will be key in terms of unlocking this. I just want to move on to how you see the $8.5 billion best catalyzing that $250 billion based on the research that you've done.
Well, Michael, I think if the bulk of the capital is concessional finance at interest rates lower than what we can get as a sovereign, in our sovereign loans, that portion is probably best invested in the transmission system, especially if the new national transmission company of South Africa has the kind of balance sheet that can take on more debt. And if you could strengthen and extend the transmission grid, that would enable IPPs to be more IPPs to be connected to the grid, independent power producers with their own private sector funding. So that's a very convenient marriage. But you also need to make sure that the $8.5 billion, as Amar said, needs to include a significant amount of zero interest or ideally grant financing in order to make a significant impact on the just part of the energy transition, in particular in the Mpumalanga region. So those would be the two priority areas. I don't think you're looking at the bulk of that funding going into renewable energy power generation. There is funding for that. You could put some of that into assisting with coal closure or accelerated or early closure of coal mines and coal-fired power stations. But that would be quite challenging.
One of the big challenges, Amar, that I see at the moment is also aligning the right type of capital with the right types of investments and getting those institutional frameworks and agreements right. How much work, as far as you are aware of, has been done so far in the background by the various task forces that have been set up between South Africa and the international donors to ensure that we get that structural arrangement right?
Well, Daniel Manele is appointed by the president to lead the task team that is engaging with the international donors. And so his task is twofold. One is to figure out exactly what the donors have in mind, what they have available, but probably more importantly, to make sure that the South African stakeholders agree on a pipeline of projects that are fundable. And getting agreement on that pipeline of projects is going to be quite a challenging task. But I think what's also important, just to what I think is actually maybe even more important than in terms of your question, is that the Presidential Climate Commission has invited the chief executives of South Africa's development finance institutions, like the IDC, like the PIC, like the DBSA, to put together a forum to discuss this issue. And it's chaired by the chief executive of the DBSA, Patrick Dlamini. And that forum, I think, is very, very significant, because it's the first time that these DFIs are coming together and saying, okay, how do we collaborate to make sure that our very substantial capital base, capital markets, and institutional capacity are mobilized in the most effective way to ensure that the internal resources within South Africa are catalyzed by this external import. Mm. And the internal resources are on a much bigger scale than the 8.5 billion that is being made available by the donors. As South Africans, we focus on the outside and how the outside is needed to help us, but we don't focus sufficiently on the inside and what we do have to make it work.
Yeah, I mean, one just has to look at what sits under ASISA's management and various pension funds in the country. We have significant pools of capital, and it is about mobilizing that project pipeline. It's interesting you mentioned that at a steel conference about 3 weeks ago, the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, addressing an audience of manufacturers, fabricators, upstream players like AMSA, said, bring us your projects, you know, so that we can help pool these in and start developing a project pipeline that will go beyond just the 8.5 billion. And there's significant opportunity here, Mark, to provide green steel, for example, to Europe down in Saldanha Bay. Are we doing enough to communicate the and frame this in those terms? In, you know, we often talk about the risk of Eskom and the risk of not transitioning and how to move, you know, vested interests in coal trucking, for example. We don't seem to do a very good job in framing the opportunity, which seems massive.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we talk with some horror about the coming carbon border taxes that will affect our carbon intensive exports, but we don't talk enough about the huge potential for a completely different set of exports. For example, green hydrogen is now being discussed, and that has got a lot of potential, not just for internal consumption, but export. But just coming to your point about, is there sufficient support? You know, I'm working with a young black BE investor who's working with a women's investment group and a German technician to design a windmill manufacturing plant in Saldanha that would have 85% local content. There's no support for them. They struggle along. There isn't really significant like institutional research support like from the CSIR or engagement with the public service in DTI around the kinds of support that could be gained in order to kind of figure out how to build South Africa's first windmill manufacturing plant, which in turn would really set an example of what is possible within the South African context. They're working in very isolated ways, and I don't think that's really going to do the trick. Mm. We need a much more collaborative way of working. Look what's happened with the standoff. The IPPs are saying we're not reaching financial close until we get a deal on local content requirements. What that means is, they want to keep the lights on, but people won't have jobs. Well, what's the point of that?
Yeah. On that issue, Amar, what is your perspective from outside South Africa looking in? It's always interesting to get that perspective when it comes to things like localization, which in a normal environment, I think one could 100% support to leverage this huge build-out over the next 30, 40 years into building industrial capacity. But right now, South Africa is in a state of emergency and crisis. We need to get as many megawatts onto the grid as fast as possible. And there are many out there. A former CEO of a big investment bank said, let's put the localization issue to one side over the next 24 months. Let's just ensure we get as many megawatts on the grid as possible to stabilize South Africa, which really seems to be on the brink of civil unrest. And we saw it last July because the economy is not growing. It's not creating jobs. From an international perspective, how do you view that discussion?
Well, from the international perspective, also don't forget about the effects of the Ukraine war, which has sent energy prices, you know, soaring and created huge volatility and a focus on energy security everywhere in the world. So South Africa is very much part of that. And in that context, there is a short-run sort of impetus towards keeping things going, so that we have the energy and that we are, in some sense, meeting our immediate objectives, recognizing that actually the long-term imperative to go the clean energy and renewables route has become even more attractive. So how do you balance those two? And in a sense, I very much of the same mind as Mark, that there are really two big investments that have to lead. The first, I agree very much, the build out of the transmission network can be a way to use public finance wisely and create the enabling conditions for an accelerated rollout of renewables. We don't need to wait on that. So that program and building that out quickly must be an immediate priority and will be beneficial economically, socially, in a countervailing way. So I think that has to be at the top of the list. Second, in terms of, long-term strategy, I don't think, a just transition will work if everything is imported. It's not going to produce the down, the upstream jobs and the downstream jobs. A lot of this is going to be about transformation of demand in very, very fundamental ways. And so I do think that South Africa needs to think about an industrial policy. Let's call it what it is. It's an industrial policy, but it has to be an industrial policy that does not, in some sense, kill the baby. So you have to have an approach that says, we will build this out, and how do we incentivize it, but also ensure that, there is a dynamic kind of a game so that you provide subsidies, you provide support, but it has to be with, time-bound windows. Mm-hmm. Economists have thought about this in many other circumstances, but South Africa does need a strategy and a clear policy around which expectations can fall.
What I'm hearing are temporary shields, but not permanent protection to enable dynamic competitive forces to evolve over time. Mark, I just want to end off now with your Eskom proposal, which really has attracted a lot of debate and discussion this week. I think many people are 100% behind your call for some coordinated national effort here, similar to a 2010 World Cup, which is great. 15 megawatts on the grid, 3 megawatts of battery energy storage. The question seems to be, why Eskom at the center of managing this? Can you just share your thoughts as to why you want Eskom as the lead coordinating actor here?
Yeah, I think, the point of departure is we can't have a national emergency plan to get 10 gigs onto the grid and 5 gigs of storage without some kind of central point of coordination and facilitation. That's the key issue. So some people say that should be Operation Vula in the presidency. I'm not sure that's the kind of work that they do. They would be key in setting up the framework, but you're talking about the need for a whole bunch of engineers who know how to build the stuff and procure it. Who else other than Eskom? Yes, Eskom's lost a lot of capability. Yes, Eskom is not exactly legitimate in the eyes of the public. But who else? Another SOE? Show me one that can do it. A private sector consortium? Will that really do the trick? I really do think we should consider seriously a role for Eskom as that key point of coordination and facilitation. I do think, I really have confidence that they will rise to the occasion. And we should get beyond this favorite South Africa pastime of Eskom bashing. Mm-hmm. Let's get around our public entity and make it work.
Yeah, but see it rise to a rating that's better than sovereign. It was AAA and even better than the sovereign at one stage potentially could be there again. Amar, just as a last point here, and on this issue of transition finance, the CEO of 91, one of the country's largest asset managers, Hendrik du Toit, wrote recently that, and I want to quote here, there is an incontrovertible and sobering fact that the drive to net zero, any effort that doesn't work for the whole world will fail everywhere. And he really says that it's all stick and no carrot. For coal-dependent trading partners like South Africa or Indonesia, we have to have policies that don't undermine their development in this race to net zero. So again, back to my earlier points about the difficult negotiations that take place at these COPs, are you getting the sense that the developed world is ready to grasp the nettle in terms of making concessions around its involvement in global warming and to use a word that I don't really want to speak of, sort of reparations for the developing world, who are bearing the brunt in an outsized manner, considering their emissions only sit at 4%, specifically here in Africa.
So let me break it down into three parts. So the CEO of 91 correctly says that an incentive structure which just rewards investors to hold green assets will not be a powerful instrument for transition, because what you want are those with, you know, the non-green assets to transit out. So his vision and his approach, I think, is entirely right, which is how do you get firms, you know, SOEs, private firms that are actually heavily invested in the fossil fuel business to exit out, you know. It's not that there are some, you know, good, bad investments and good investments, and somehow if you just finance the good investments, you have brought about the transition. So that's the first point, which is how do we get transition finance to finance the transitions that are needed? The second is for Africa. South Africa is, you know, and there are some fossil fuel producers that are in the same space, which is a very, very heavily fossil fuel dependent economy. And how do you, in some sense, get the transition out? So, you know, as an outsider, but as still somebody quite, I think, you know, aware of the very, very difficult circumstances in South Africa that Mark started this discussion with, I do believe the international community must help finance the costs associated with early exit from coal. There are financial costs, there are social costs, and there must be some sharing in those costs. And it has to be debt-free finance. It has to be low-cost finance. And at the moment, you know, the first package is, in some sense, dealing with closures that are not the most difficult. As you move down the pike and you're looking at younger plants, the costs will increase. And we need a mechanism to finance that. One such mechanism that some of us think have potential are voluntary carbon markets. Because on the other side, there are people who are willing to put money because they feel that they want to contribute to the reduction of carbon emissions, and where better to put it rather than the early exit of coal, the lowest hanging fruit in terms of decarbonization. And the third is the issue of the rest of Africa. You know, Africa is the area is starting, as you say, with the lowest base, but it is the continent that will see the highest increases in energy infrastructure and indeed in all of infrastructure. And we have to remember that most African countries are not investment grade. You know, these are not places which are going to attract autonomous pools of private capital. The international community has to be able to step up for a just transition, not in the narrow sense of energy, but a just transition to enable the people of Africa to actually invest in all forms of capital, human, physical, as well as natural. And the scale of finance that will be necessary is much, much larger than anything that is on the table right now. So as somebody from the outside, I will press very hard at COP27 to ensure that we have a total package that is commensurate to ambition. And the ambition for Africa is one of leapfrogging and avoiding the mistakes of the past.
Amar Bhattacharya, thank you very much. Senior Fellow in the Center for Sustainable Development, housed in the Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings. Thank you very much for your time. And so too to Mark Swilling, a professor at the Center for Sustainability Transitions at Stellenbosch University, talking about really what is the existential question, not only for South Africa, but for the world, as the world looks to implement a just transition. You're watching Business Watch.